Iran says its agreement with the IAEA on the installation of new cameras at the Karaj centrifuge facility is a goodwill gesture after the agency condemned an act of sabotage there. Syria confronts Israeli missile strike. Attack claims life of a soldier while air defenses intercept most of the missiles. And the Yemeni army says its ballistic missiles have hit vital targets, including an air base in the southern Saudi cities of Jizan and Khamis Mushayed. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, our top story. Iran says that it will not accept any proposal in the Vienna talks which would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian told UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres Tehran is ready to negotiate a good deal. Iran's top diplomat has blamed slow progress and talks on other signatories' lack of initiative, while noting threats have never worked in the case of Iran. Amir Abdollahian says Iran has allowed cameras to be replaced at its Karaj centrifuge complex after the UN nuclear watchdog denounced a sabotage attack there. He described the move as Iran's goodwill gesture. Guterres, for his part, voiced support for the process in Vienna to revive the JCPOA.
Iran and the UN Atomic Agency have reached a deal concerning the IAEA's inspection of a centrifuge facility. Tehran has agreed to let the watchdog replace damaged cameras at its site in Karaj. The International Atomic Energy Agency has been seeking to replace the devices which were damaged in a sabotage attack in June, which Iran blames on Israel. The issue was discussed during IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi's two trips to Tehran in recent months, but no agreement could be reached. The IAEA touted the agreement as an important development for its verification and monitoring activities in Iran. It also hoped that the two sides would continue to work to resolve remaining safeguard issues. Iran's foreign minister, for his part, called it a good agreement to ease alleged concerns over the country's peaceful nuclear activities. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the agreement would boost cooperation between Tehran and the agency, despite the fact that the IAEA has occasionally taken politically motivated decisions regarding Iran.
Unfortunately, as Iran told Mr. Grossi during his recent trip to Tehran, the agency is substantially deviating from its mission. The agency sometimes focuses on political issues instead of focusing on technical issues, and this creates problems concerning cooperation between the IAEA and Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. In recent days, we faced the same problem. The agency used technical tools to wield political influence on the Vienna talks.
The announcement comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are busy discussing how to revive the accord, which the U.S. withdrew unilaterally in 2018. Iran says it wants the removal of all sanctions inconsistent with the JCPOA in a verifiable manner. Tehran also wants a firm guarantee that Washington would not quit the deal ever again.
Now Israel has carried out yet another missile strike against Syrian positions in the country's south, leaving one soldier dead. The Syrian media are quoted as military sources saying that aerial attacks were launched from the occupied Golan Heights. According to the source, Syrian defense systems intercepted most of the missiles. The assault has also caused some material damage there. Israel frequently launches airstrikes on Syria. Damascus has time and again condemned the attacks as violations of its sovereignty and filed multiple complaints to the United Nations. Israel has forced Palestinians in occupied East Al-Quds to demolish their homes, leaving more than two dozen people homeless. Now, some Palestinians whose homes are subject to demolitions raised them themselves to avoid further penalties. For more on that, earlier we were joined by our guests in our news review program. Here it is. Welcome everyone to a news review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top story. Now over two dozen more Palestinians become homeless as the Israeli regime forces them to leave their ancestral homes in occupied East Al-Quds. A family of 27 in the Silwan neighborhood has been targeted this time. They are pressed by regime officials to leave and demolish their own homes. Many of those left homeless include children and the elderly. On Tuesday, Israeli forces bulldozed the remains of a Palestinian house in the same neighborhood. Some of the Palestinians whose homes are subject to demolitions raised them by their own hands to avoid further penalties. The Israeli regime regularly flattens Palestinian homes and structures in Al-Quds under the pretext they lack building permits, but Palestinians and rights groups say moves are only aimed at grabbing more Palestinian land to expand Israeli settlements, which are all illegal under international law. Joining us now for the program is Rabab Abuladi, a senior scholar and director at Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco, and Firas Al-Najim, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us from Ottawa, Ontario. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. We'll start with you, Dr. Abuladi. Your thoughts on, we know that this is a serious human rights violation. It's a serious concern, not just for Palestinians, but for anyone that's interested in peace in occupied territories. Why do the Palestinians have to endure this kind of treatment? I mean, we know they deal with all kinds of marginalization by the Israeli regime, but having their own homes demolished when the regime does not give them building permits, what are they to do?
Well, the only thing that they can do is resist and refuse Israeli attempts that are trying to completely erase Palestine and Palestinian existence and the will of the Palestinian people. It is a very sad situation. It's a crime against humanity, and let's call it what it is. It's a crime against humanity. It's a collective punishment, and it is a project of settler colonial regime that tries to erase the indigenous people of the land in order to replace them with immigrants from all over the world and claim that the land is not theirs. The reality of the matter is that Palestinians have been enduring this treatment for a very long time. Actually, even Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel themselves are also oftentimes forced to raise their own homes. It costs at least $150,000 to raise the home. And then they also sometimes have to pay for the Israeli helicopters and the dogs that come along with the Israeli military establishment to destroy Palestinian homes. This is nothing more than, it is a crime against humanity, it's a violation of human rights. It's actually making people homeless in their own homes. And what Israel is trying to do by this is to actually empty Jerusalem from Palestinians, Judaize Jerusalem, take it over and claim that it is the eternal capital of Israel. This has failed again and again by the resistance of the people in Silwan, by the resistance of people in Sheikh Jarrah, by the resistance of the Palestinians in the old city of Jerusalem, by the Murabitat women who are staying there guarding the Aqsa Mosque, by the majority of the Palestinian people from all religious backgrounds who are speaking up against it, and first and foremost, actually, by the resistance of the Palestinians themselves to this. But it does not make it any less inhumane, it does not make it any less a violation of human rights, and the whole world should be outraged by these continued attempts by Israel to act as nothing more like the apartheid and colonial regime.
Thank you, Doctor. And Firas, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Ontario. Firas, what do you call it when a regime takes your land by force, makes you demolish your own home there, 27 families, children and the elderly involved, you know, driven out in the cold, pre-winter cold out here in the Middle East. I don't know if you're familiar, but I don't know if, well, actually you're in Canada, so I'm sure you're familiar with the cold. But to make a long story short, what do you call it? What do you call it when they take your land, then they make you demolish your own home so you don't have to pay for them to do it for you and leave you out in the cold? What is that called, Firas?
Yes. Like the sister said, this is a crime against humanity, and we're all witnessing this. We're lucky to be in an era where there is clear proof, and we have all this technology where people can capture these things, with the videos, with the video cameras, with the sophisticated phones, and this clarifies to the world that these crimes should not have people sitting around watching these crimes without doing something about it. And we hold more accountable, obviously, the United Nations that watching all these crimes accumulate and continuous crimes, the countless violations of international law, countless human rights violations, attacks on civilians all day and night, like taking over people's homes and also enforcing them to demolish their own homes and suffer and watch. The children have to watch the place they were raised in, or the seniors have to watch the place where they grew their olive trees outside and they were eating outside in their backyard and enjoying their home for many years. And this is part of their history and a part of their, they thought it was part of their future, and all of a sudden their future is no more home. So, why preach about human rights? All these countries that support the Zionist regime, and they're the same ones that sit around and try to condemn other countries and other places in the world, and leave Israel to just keep committing all these crimes without holding them accountable. We never hear anything about sanctions against Israel. We only hear them, a lot of countries, trying to stop people that are, for instance, resisting by boycotting Israeli product and calling this anti-Semitic, or trying to say that these people are against a certain regime. They're just selectively choosing this regime as if this regime innocent, and you just leave it alone.
Thank you, Firaz, for your input there. Rabab Abdul-Hadi, a senior scholar at the director at Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diasporas Studies in San Francisco, California, and Mr. Firaz Al-Najim, their manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights from Ottawa, Ontario, joining us on the program. And that's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. And welcome back, everyone. The Yemeni army says it's carried out a large-scale operation in southwestern Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's deadly assaults and ongoing siege on Yemen. Army spokesperson says a barrage of ballistic missiles has accurately hit vital targets in the city of Jizan, as well as warplane hangars at King Khalid Air Base near the city of Khamis Mushayyid. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia says it's intercepted two ballistic missiles over the southern city of Abha. Riyadh, along with some of its Arab allies, launched a military campaign against Yemen in March of 2015. War has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and plunged Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says recent operations against the Saudis show Yemenis now have the upper hand in this war.
We have seen in the recent last 2-3 years, Yemeni army has launched many attacks using sometimes up to 40 ballistic missile and drone and drones, and as well other missiles, like the attack that happened about a week ago. And this showed exactly that the war against Yemen has actually failed. And Yahya Sari, the spokesperson, have said that the Yemeni army is ready to launch a bigger and broader attack against Saudi Arabia if they are not going to stop their war and their crime committed against Yemeni civilians, and if they are not going to lift the blockade. And at this point, Yemeni army is the one who have in the upper hand. They are advancing toward and controlling and liberating many areas around the Marib city. This war actually has exposed Saudi Arabia, and it shows how weak is this coalition, even though it's supported by United States, UK, and France. But it showed that Yemeni resistance actually is the one that actually will win, and they are advancing on the ground. They are launching attack. They are targeting shooting down Saudi fighter jet and drones as well. This shows that now the upper hand is for the Yemeni army.
U.S. Congress votes to launch a commission to study failures of the 20-year war in Afghanistan, which came to an end with the chaotic withdrawal of American troops last summer. The panel is part of a $768 billion annual defense bill passed overwhelmingly by the Senate. Commission on America's Longest War will have 16 members, It has to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting and a final one in 3 years. U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 led to the ouster of the Taliban, but the group rose to power again in August as foreign forces were leaving the war-torn country. According to the U.S. Defense Department, wars cost American taxpayers some $955 billion. Now, Britain records more than 78,000 new COVID infections, highest daily tally since the start of the pandemic. UK also registered 165 deaths in the past 24 hours. Rise in coronavirus infections and fatalities is largely attributed to a spread of the Omicron variant. Health officials have warned of a staggering increase in cases in the next few days. They also say sheer numbers of infections could lead to mounting fatalities and an overwhelmed healthcare system. Now, Britain's opposition Labour Party leader has come down hard on Prime Minister Boris Johnson over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
Mr. Speaker, the virus is spreading once again and lives and livelihoods are at risk. The British public are looking for a Prime Minister with the trust and the authority to lead Britain through the crisis. Instead, we're burdened with the worst possible Prime Minister at the worst possible time.
Keir Starmer added Johnson is too weak to lead. Premier Albert claims that he had taken a balanced and proportionate approach toward tackling the pandemic, which was right for the United Kingdom. This comes the day after nearly 100 of the MPs' own party, the Prime Minister's own party MPs, that has broke ranks and rebelled against new restrictions over the spread of the Omicron variant. Johnson's also facing back-to-back scandals, which have undermined his own popularity, as well as support for the Conservatives. People are angry over a leaked video showing Johnson's top aides joking about a Downing Street Christmas party during last year's COVID lockdown. Prime Minister is also under fire over the costly refurbishment of his residence. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The U.S. is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kerry Peterson-Smith Ryder. This article is published under the heading Saudi Arabia Arms Sales is one of Biden's many militaristic actions in first year. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you.
given the brutish approach of his predecessor, many expected President Joe Biden to shift away from the worst practices in U.S. foreign policy and at the border in the previous 4 years. Indeed, in the first weeks of his presidency, the Biden administration signaled changes. In Secretary of State Antony Blinken's first press briefing, the State Department announced that it was reviewing weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which have led the catastrophic war in Yemen with essential U.S. partnership. A week later, Biden declared in his first foreign policy address as president that we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Regarding his practices at the border, Biden administration officials promised a shift away from Trump's practices of separating families and caging children, calling them a moral failing. He said that the new White House would deal with immigration comprehensively, fairly, and humanely. As 2021 comes to a close, however, we are seeing the latter part of the trajectory that settles into familiar, disastrous militarism. The United States is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. These arrangements come as Saudi Arabia is escalating its devastating bombing in Yemen. In November, Saudi forces carried out the largest number of airstrikes since Trump's last year in office. These bookends, Biden's early announcement of an end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen and his subsequent robust material support of that war, captured the set of practices that the Biden White House is settling into, not only in Yemen, but also in the realm of war and imperialism more broadly. Consider the White House's approval of a $23 billion weapons sales to the UAE, which provides the Emirates with attack drones and F-35 fighter jets. The arrangement was negotiated under the Trump administration as the prize for the UAE's role in leading the normalization of diplomatic relations between the Zionist regime and itself, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, despite the Zionist regime's deepening violence against Palestinians. The Biden administration embraced the normalization agreements along with Trump's other actions meant to consolidate U.S. support and extend legitimacy to the Zionist regime in a time when Palestinian protest presents a steady challenge to the Israeli apartheid and global Palestine solidarity campaigns have gained more traction than ever. Trump fulfilled long-standing wishes of the Israeli regime right wing, including moving the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds from Tel Aviv, declaring the legality of the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank, which are considered unambiguously illegal according to international law, and endorsing the Zionist regime occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. Yet, when it comes to concrete action, Biden has accepted and continued along his predecessor's path. This continuity is also painfully evident regarding Biden's actions toward migrants, many of whom have been displaced due to U.S. imperialist policies. For example, in the face of severe social, political, and economic crises in Central America, which are driven by decades of Washington-directed economic policies and brutal repression carried out by U.S. armed regimes in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, Kamala Harris in Guatemala City, on her first overseas tour as vice president, presented the U.S. foreign policy in cruelty do not come. Once they approach or enter the country, migrants face a complex of forces that remains in place to detain, incarcerate, and deport migrants and prevent their entry to the United States. Biden has maintained the use of Title 42, a statute that allows the federal government special powers in public health emergencies to deny migrants, including asylum seekers, access at the U.S.-Mexico border in violation of international law. Biden is thus continuing Trump's use of the measure, which was invoked when the COVID-19 pandemic began. Public health professionals and scholars have argued that the measure cannot be justified in the name of public health and have called upon the administration to end it. Biden has also reopened some of the most notorious detention sites highlighted in the Trump era, including Florida's Homestead Shelter for Unaccompanied Children. The numbers of people in detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, have swelled to 22,000 under Biden, marking a 56% increase since the day the new president took office. Biden's most dramatic and revealing act at the border this year was his handling of the arrival of thousands of primarily Haitian asylum seekers at Del Rio, Texas in September. From border patrol agents on horseback whipping the black migrants to their confinement in squalid conditions on riverbanks and under a bridge, the U.S. government and its police forces engaged in racist violence, treating the Haitians as a criminal threat to its contained rather than vulnerable people with the right to seek refuge and asylum. Biden deported the groups of thousands to Haiti in an operation that revealed the logistical capacity at his disposal, which could, of course, instead be used to welcome people and support their survival. Finally, the Biden administration has resumed Trump's infamous Remain in Mexico policy, which forces people seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border to apply in Mexico and wait there while their applications are processed. The policy goes against the U.S. law, which guarantees people the right to apply for asylum inside the U.S., regardless of how they entered. Biden initially opposed the program, suspending it in February. In the face of rulings by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, however, the White House negotiated a new version of the policy with the Mexican government and has begun to administer it, the program which made tens of thousands of asylum seekers vulnerable to kidnapping, assault, and other hazards in Mexico under Trump, is now Biden's. At the moment, Afghanistan faces mass hunger and an economic catastrophe as billions of dollars belonging to the Afghan Central Bank sit in the United States, frozen by order of Biden administration. Yet amid these blatant continuations of state violence, grassroots pressure has clearly made an impact. Biden's rhetorical vows to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen, for example, MTS Day War, were responses in significant part to a years-long, consistent and vocal challenge of U.S. support for the war.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special.
There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Again, we are here to present with another episode of A Muslim Lady, where we have been discussing so many important issues regarding Muslim lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studios, my wife Razia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm just thanking Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala to having this great opportunity. It's a biggest way of worshipping Allah. Thank you so much.
So, inshallah, today we are going to discuss about a very important and interesting topic, you know, which is the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah ta'ala Ali. Yeah, you know, this great man, how much changes he has brought in our society, in Muslim society. And one of it is regarding our Muslim lady.
Yeah, the moment you said Imam Khomeini, everyone knows about his revolution about this country, Iran. But I usually say the revolution was from inside the human kind throughout the world. And especially he was a big blessing of Allah for us as a Muslim practicing ladies. Until now, I'm just thanking Allah that Allah has given me life, and my life was in this era, in this time, because the freedom, the respect, the rights, which as a Muslim lady, I myself have experienced because of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. I don't think so I would have that many blessings in other times.
Yeah, especially from the West, they were thinking that Islam does not care about the rights of women, yeah? Because of so many Muslim, so-called Muslim countries, because we, even nowadays, we see that no any right of Muslim ladies or our women is taken care of. So somehow he has given a very good practical answer to the criticism of, you know, Western societies. That so Islam is, limits, you know, Islam, if you accept Islam, it means you are limited. You can't do social activities, you can't play any role in your society. So by bringing revolution in this part of the world and giving freedom to Muslim ladies, he has answered them, you know, practically answered them, and he has shut their mouths closed. You know, beautifully. So look at this, you know, modern Islamic Republic of Iran, where women play role shoulder by shoulder to gents and males.
No doubt.
And having their own hijab, having their own chastity, modesty. So this is the true Islam. So all this credit goes to the great personality of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah ta'ala. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah ta'ala Ali. I just want to mention a quote from him that he says, "My daughter, all the prophets have come to, you know, elevate all the human beings. And they have come to remove all the curtains, all the obstacles. So by saying this, he wants to say that Islam does not put any hijab or curtain in front of you, you know. You can go through all these progress in your life. Spiritually, you can play your role in your society. So how beautifully he describes. It means that in that time, he was a very open-minded and very, very intelligent person. Because in his society, when he was studying in the Islamic seminary of Najaf, you know, there wasn't any facility for women to study.
Oh, yeah, I have heard. You know, therefore, we can realize his role and his very revolutionary mindset, you know, because like Najaf is also, until now, it's a center of knowledge. It's a Muslim, Shia, you know, city, definitely very holy city. And Qom is also. I think because, you know, you can see all the beautiful attributes of prophets and messengers of Allah in this great man. Because if you study Islam, you always see Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala, he has started the journey of guidance for us mankind from Adam and Hawa. So both are there, Adam and Hawa. Both, they went to Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala to repent. Both have done Tawbah. And Allah has accepted Tawbah from both of them. Although Adam, alayhi salam, is a prophet. But Hawa's role as a spiritual role model is still there. And then if you come, you know, along to like the time of Prophet Ibrahim, you can see Sarah, the role of Lady Hajra. You can see the role of, in the time of Moses, the role of the mother and the sister, and Lady Asiya and Lady Maryam. You know, the wonders are there. So you cannot neglect the role of women, which Allah has given. And prophets are the protector of that role. And after prophet, the great scholars, especially like Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi.
Yeah, definitely. And you can see how in the era of our Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, how the women, the great ladies, they played their role. So, which means Islam has provided equally the rights to our, ladies and male. They can both play, but yeah, they have priorities.
Yeah. You know, whenever people, they talk about the equality, I say, why it shouldn't be equal? Why? You know, this I have learned from the school thought of Imam Khomeini, which is a school thought of Quran and Ahlul Bayt. So, because, you know, we as a human being, we are made of soul and body. And our soul cannot be divided to male and female, but our body can be divided. So, the division comes when something we have to play our responsibility, duties in this world. Yeah, physical world. But the spiritually, the connection to Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala and the level and standard of understanding the concept of God, you know, those the main, the very supreme, you know, ideologies.
Women in Imam Khomeini's idea.
When talking about the infant of Islam and the spiritual disposition of the infant, Imam Khomeini observes that you should know that Islam incorporates all things before marriage occurs between a woman and a man until the time they are laid to rest. Islam has canons, it has teachings, it has progressive instructions which are useful for man's happiness, both in this world and in the afterlife. Sahifa Ye Imam, Volume 6, page 191.
are talking about the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali. The Quran also says whenever it talks about the spiritual journey, the nearness to Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala, it does not mention male or female. It says, Inna akramakum indallahi atqakum.
No doubt.
No, whoever is more pious, he is closer to Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala. He is more honorable. He is more respectful. Throughout all these verses of the Holy Quran, we cannot find a single verse which differentiates between men and women. Except those, you know, inheritance or whenever it comes to, you know, physical things, then it says that your female rights are these and their inheritance is like this.
That is for this world, you know, like
the, and limited issues. Exactly. Otherwise, generally speaking, the Holy Quran never ever differentiates between men
one story,
and female.
Khalada, this says, you know, that the mindset of prophets and Imam Khomeini. Khalada, she was a lady, normal lady, okay? So Allah Tabarak wa Ta'ala asked a prophet Dawood to go and visit Khalada because she would be in your company in heaven, in Jannah. So Prophet Dawood went to the house of Khalada. He knocked the door and he said, "Are you Khalada bint Uwais?" She said, "Yes, I am." And then he said, "I'm a prophet. Allah has sent me to your house." She said, "How come you are coming to my house? You know, there should be any name mistake. I'm not an extraordinary person. This is a wrong address." But he said, "No, this is right address. Can you just tell me your habits, your lifestyle?" She said, "Nothing I have special." Look, that kind of humbleness, you know. So she said, "Nothing. People, they would think that I'm suffering a lot from so many problems. But yeah, I know those are tests. And I'm so much satisfied by distribution of Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. So I'm always happy, you know. I'm satisfied." So the way she was so much humble, down to earth, and full of contentment, Prophet Dawood, he said, "Yeah, you are the person. You know, Allah has observed and Allah bought this quality because Allah, we are selling our life to Allah. Inna Allah ashtara." So Allah is buying and Allah is appreciating the quality of humbleness, you know, honesty and satisfaction. So those qualities are important, not a person. So she's a lady, you know. But look at the concept of Islam and Quran and Prophet, that a lady or a man, whoever has that quality, Allah is just
no
elevating
matter,
the status.
So until our next episode,
Assalamu
alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah,
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
What happened on 6th of January was an attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election results and the rule of law. That threat is far from over. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Rebecca Solnit. The piece is titled, America Witnessed a Coup Attempt, Now It's Sleepwalking into Another Disaster. Even as the mob ran screaming and smashing through the Capitol on 6th of January, it was clear this was a coup attempt. It was equally clear that it had been instigated by the then president and his circle, much of whose audience in the Stop the Steal rally would become that mob. Everything since has been filled in, important in building the legal case against the leaders of this attempted coup and establishing the facts for history and public knowledge. And one hopes for efforts to prevent another such attempt. That the goal was a coup is a solemnly horrifying fact. That those who orchestrated it and those who have excused and dismissed it afterward continue to conspire against the rule of law and the right of the people to choose their leaders is another such fact. Documents such as the PowerPoint presentation turned over to the 6th of January House Commission by Donald Trump's then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows confirmed the details and build our understanding of the threat. On the basis of sometimes ridiculous pretext, the circle around Donald Trump intended to steal the election and seize power. Many, including Utah Senator Mike Lee and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, reportedly knew the agenda. Had they succeeded in grabbing power with such an openly lawless act, they could have kept it only by suspending the rule of law. This is what a dictatorship is, and this is what they wanted. A government in which laws are nothing, and the ruling junta or thug is everything. What the American people and foreign nations would have done in response might have overturned it further down the road, had it not failed on that day. But the whole business is still terrifying, and the threat is certainly not over. It was clear the military leadership was already alarmed. On 3rd of January 2021, all 10 living U.S. Secretaries of Defense co-authored an editorial declaring efforts to involve the U.S. armed forces in resolving election disputes would take us into dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional territory. Few Republicans would defend the U.S. Constitution, the voice of the voters, and the orderly transition of power was also obvious. At 1:09 p.m. on that day, the Capitol Police Chief said he wanted to declare an emergency and call in the National Guard. At 1:11 p.m., Donald Trump ended his speech with the words, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." At 1:12 p.m., two of America's slimiest elected officials, Congressman Paul Gosar and Senator Ted Cruz, were objecting to certifying Arizona's electoral votes. Congressman Paul Gosar, according to two participants in the riot, seemed to know what was coming and had promised blanket pardons. The evacuation of the House and the Senate would begin an hour later. At 2:24, Donald Trump tweeted, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution." Two conservative Republicans, Vice President Mike Pence and Congresswoman Liz Cheney, have been among the few to refuse to participate in the coup. And also in the big lie and the surrounding corruption, and have paid for it. That terrible day, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy reportedly called Donald Trump to rage and curse at him and demand he call the mob off. But he would then fall in line and fudge the reality and significance of what had happened. That day, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell noted that to overturn the election results would send democracy into a death spiral. Afterward, Mitch McConnell was furious and shaken, but he too squirmed his way back into alignment with the big lie. By May, he was trying to block the formation of the 6th of January committee to investigate what had happened. The crisis isn't just that we had a coup attempt almost a year ago, but that the Republican Party was itself become so venal, so corrupt, so ruthless in its quest for power that it seems assured that we will see further attempts to overrule any election outcome that they don't like. Already, the kind of election laws they've pushed across the country seem aimed at such goals, and voter suppression has long been one of their anti-democratic tactics. It played a substantial role in Donald Trump's 2016 presidential election win and the genuine illegitimacies of that election. Foreign interference, anomalies the recount might have uncovered had the Republicans not stopped it were appropriated as false claims for 2020. The Republicans made a devil's bargain decades ago when they decided that they would not change course to win the votes of an increasingly non-white, increasingly progressive people, but would try to suppress those who would vote against them. That is, they pitted themselves against democracy as participatory government and free and fair elections. The rhetoric of the far right makes it clear that they are fearful and know their power will ebb if they cannot command and subvert the laws and elections of this nation, and they are aiming at some form of minority rule. That's perfectly clear from their attack on the constitutional process unfolding that afternoon of 6th of January, which was itself a refusal to accept an election loss. The refusal to recognize the authority of Congress by Donald Trump associates, including Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows, is further sign of their belief, emboldened by Trump's 4 years of criming in public, that they make their own rules. Both Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows have been found in contempt of Congress. The crisis isn't just that we had a coup attempt and have a political party that has gone rogue, but that much of the rest of the nation seems to be normalizing, or forgetting, or sleepwalking through the crisis. The warnings are getting more urgent. "They've decided to burn it all down with us inside," said NBC anchor Brian Williams on Thursday in his parting words before leaving the network. Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii stated on Sunday, "The road to autocracy is paved with overly chill responses from people who would see this all with great clarity if only it were happening in a faraway place." Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy declared, "This is nation-ending stuff we're dealing with here, and folks better wake up soon. I'll do my part. Think about what yours is."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.